and welcome to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
And I'm a little congested right now, so I blame my sister. One of the biggest conversation points that we've had in the world of LGBT plus people is RuPaul's Drag Race.
I mean, I haven't.
But you're an anomaly. And what we see is everybody's talking about it. It's an Emmy Award winning show. It's now international. It's in the Philippines, no, Thailand. It's now going into the UK with a whole bunch of people on there. Their guest judges include like Miley Cyrus.
And to be clear, we're not talking that like they're rebroadcasting RuPaul's Drag Race.
There's like new versions. Yeah.
It's like RuPaul's Drag Race UK kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is it RuPaul or is it just be Drag Race UK?
I mean, no, it's like RuPaul brands his stuff. Like, there is, ooh, you know, there's no way they're marketing without his branding all over it. So, I bring it up because for the first time in the US series, which is what we get here in Canada, there is a Canadian queen.
Right.
Which is Brooklyn Heights, who lives in Nashville now.
Is there a hyphen in there? Like, Brooke? Hyphen L-Y-N-N-E? Is that how that's spelled?
No, I don't think there's hyphens.
There's a missed opportunity in there to make it sound like... Because that's a good drag name, sounds like a regular name, and then you hear it again, and you're like, oh, there's a joke in there.
I don't know what the joke is in Brooklyn Heights.
Because Brooke is a common woman's name, Lynn is a common woman's name, and then Brooklyn Heights is a part of New York City.
Oh!
So it'd be Brooke hyphen Lynn, surname Heights.
Yes, okay, now I get it. Wow.
Well done.
Not gonna lie, I was like, it sounds familiar, but no, Brooklyn Heights. Okay, I get it. That took me
a minute. I mean, that's how I would spell that name if I were she.
They missed the hyphen there. Yeah. Anyway, so Brooklyn Heights, he lives in Nashville, is from Toronto in Canada. Is the first Canadian queen, walked into the workroom in a RCMP traditional uniform inspired outfit. RCMP, but it was inspired. Lots of glitter. But has gone into hot water. Now, at our time of recording, there has been all of one episode with Brooklyn Heights in the show.
Okay.
She won that particular episode. I know, I'm going to get so much hate mail. But it's been a week. And everyone's like, yay, Canadian drag queen. And now it's emerged that she posted to Instagram a photo of herself and another drag queen who was in blackface.
Okay.
From 2003. And actually hashtagged blackface.
Okay.
Just so you don't miss it.
And is it full blackface where, like, it doesn't go to the edges and the lips are white? Is it, like... Or is it, like, heavy contouring so that it's dark, skin darkening?
I'll get to that in just a minute.
Like, minstrel show blackface? Like, actual, like, holy crap, you did blackface? Or...
But no, but more... Okay, so Brooklyn says, or issued on her Instagram, that I posted the photo to my Instagram in 2014. Sorry, I thought it was 2003.
Now, to be clear, the reason why I'm making that distinction, not that it makes it okay, it's just one's in
poor taste. We will get to that.
And the other is racist. There's...
I mean, they're both... So, I posted the photo to my Instagram in 2014 and included the hashtag blackface. This post was irresponsible on my part. It was rooted in ignorance and came from a place of naivete and privilege. So, it was certainly an issue. Now, it actually comes from a performance by a prominent, at the time, Toronto drag queen, Daytona Bitch. So that's an actual name. I'm not just swearing at our audience.
Right.
And Daytona in 2013 was fired as the TD Canada Trust Pride drag queen following a performance where she actually blackened her face.
Okay.
There was a drag race at Cruise and Tango's, the big gay bar in Toronto. The theme was Caribbean Heat.
Okay.
She came dressed as Miss Cleo, the American psychic.
Oh, yes.
African-American.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to sort of authenticate the look, blackened her face.
Okay, okay.
And was then immediately fired as a result of it. Brooklyn Heights, however, Instagrammed that, hashtag blackface.
Well, I mean, Instagram didn't exist in 2003, so this must have been a recent addition.
Well, she put it on Instagram in 2014.
Okay. So
the photo was taken in 2013.
Right, okay.
You know, so that there was still a separate decision made again in 2013. So, no, having that photo taken was the first crazy decision. And then the second decision to also post it. And a part of me is like, Brooklyn Heights here didn't wear blackface.
Yeah.
We're not saying that she did.
But there's multiple stages along the way where she was like, I mean, having your picture taken with your friends, that happens. But then having your picture taken with your friends and then posting it on Instagram and then tagging it with blackface and then not taking it down in a purge before you become a celebrity and then kind of not really apologizing about it until the last minute. Like, there's multiple steps along the way where this was a road filled with escape hatches that were not taken.
So Daytona, the queen in question, said that she didn't think it was blackface. She was portraying a character.
Yeah.
It was a caricature of somebody.
Right.
Others accused it of being a racist minstrel show. At the time, it was hotly debated, and she actually lost all of her shows during Toronto Pride.
Right,
massive financial impact. She apologized, and there was others who were doing other types of questionable cultural appropriating outfits. So there was a lot of, back in 2013, it was a mess.
Yeah.
2014, Brooklyn Heights still posts it. And the part of me is like, you know, what's unforgivable in this case is that Brooklyn Heights should have known better.
By then, yeah.
Because there was massive backlash at the time. Daytona lost all of her jobs because of it.
Yeah.
That it was in the media. It was everywhere. It was a big thing. So for that to have been missed by Brooklyn Heights, and for her to attribute that to naivete, I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it. I think that she should have known better at the time. And I don't know how we accommodate that.
Even if you're going to say, I was a big dum-dum and didn't know better, you could at least say, well, this other person who basically lost their career over it, who you knew personally, you should have probably looked at them and said, well, they did this thing. I don't know why it's offensive, but apparently it is. Maybe I should not do that thing. I mean, that's the minimum there. That's a pretty low standard. But yeah, I don't know.
Moving on to our next topic, where a CBC reporter who is covering at a comedy bar in Toronto, who is doing a live report. His name is Chris Glover. He is a handsome reporter. Most reporters are handsome or attractive.
Yeah.
That's sort of, I think, part of the gig. And he's there reporting, and we won't show the footage because it's radio and you don't really get an idea of what's going on.
Right.
So what happens in it is he's in Toronto, he's at this comedy bar, and there's a comedian, Boyd Banks, who comes up behind him and is, you know, reporters live on the street and they pop up behind the shoulder and like wave to mum and that kind
yeah,
of
yeah.
You know, that sort of thing always happens. It's sort of to be expected. So Boyd Banks is hovering over his shoulder and then like just leans in and like nuzzles up to his face and then starts licking his ear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird.
Mm-hmm.
And poor Chris Glover is like edging away, trying to turn away, trying to shut down the conversation. Like, actually, you know, this is really, you know, there's a lot going on here. Over to you. And what really got to me was the anchor said, you know, you should, yeah, that's a little strange. It's really an unnecessary move away from the gentleman. To which you can hear Chris Glover going, no, I can't.
Yeah.
And in the footage, he's surrounded by people. Like, there's nowhere to go. And, like, he can't move away from the guy licking his ear, which
right.
is just bizarre. The CBC, the Canadian public broadcaster, issued a statement saying, while some observers argued the actions amounted to an assault or sexual assault, Glover told the Canadian press he would leave it up to the police to make that determination. What certainly said was how the incident made him feel, and I'm quoting here from Chris Glover, "I, as a journalist, was just trying to do my job. I feel deeply disturbed by what happened. I still feel like it was completely uncalled for. The whole thing really made me feel really awkward, uncomfortable, and embarrassed." It was inappropriate. Like, if you, we will include links to our show. It's the CBC Chris Glover at a live remote in the Canadian Comedy Club in Toronto. Check it out. It is awkward to watch because it's so bizarre. Nobody should just straight up walk up and lick somebody's ear. That's such a strange thing to do.
Well, this is these are two things that are mildly old by this rate, by this point. So the one was the when Kathy Griffith was all over Anderson Cooper at New Year's a few years ago, and people played it off as just Kathy Griffith having a good time, but Anderson Cooper clearly was not comfortable with the situation. I remember at the time saying, like, this is, like, we're witnessing a little bit of sexual assault on air right now. And a lot of people were like, no, no, it's all fine. Which actually ties into the other thing, which is there's a video that's been going on recently, and it's a pop culture detective, and it's a guy who actually does film analysis primarily. But he looked at the history of playing off the sexual assault of men for comedy. And about half the video, possibly even two-thirds of the video, was specifically about prison rape jokes. And prison rape jokes are really common. But even beyond that, like, inappropriate groping and touching of men, especially gay men, is actually a common thing in the media. So, I mean, some of this was just sort of a callback to this. And, I mean, this is something that is, it's hard to talk about, if anything else, because normally when you talk about a complicated situation, you have the entire history of that difficult discussion to draw on. But people don't really talk about the sexual assault of men, especially the sexual assault of men for comedy.
Yes. So, yeah, and that's exactly, he was a comedian.
Yeah. There's very little precedent that you can fall back on and say, well, if you remember, this other thing happened. And it's,
you know, can you just imagine the outrage if a comedian had come up and started licking a female reporter's ear?
Yeah. Like,
just, it's just bizarre.
Yeah.
And so Boyd Banks issued an apology. He called himself an idiot. He goes, "There is no excuse for my behavior last night. I'm guilty of everything. I am an idiot. I want to apologize to the stand-up community in Canada and, of course, the reporter who is doing his job."
That's a very good start.
It is.
Yeah.
And I think it was stupid. It was short-sighted. He was an idiot for making that decision in the moment. But I think you're right that what's seen as permissible in terms of what's funny, it is grounded in all of that history, you know. Gay jokes have been the butt of the joke for a long time, but it's seen as less of an issue than if it was not a male.
Yeah.
Anyways, we're going to jump to our first song. Just after that, we have an interview with Gary Lacasse. Our first song is going to be Ben Platt, who is an American singer. This is the song
Luke,
"Grow As We Go."
Is your top inside out?
No.
Really?
No, it just looks like that.
Oh, that's a weird top. Luke is wearing a weird top.
Every time I wear this sweater, I have to show Jake the tags on the inside because he does not believe me every single time. Anyway, Ben Platt,
fashion.
"Grow As We Go." We'll be back just after this.
So much you don't know. You need to go and find yourself. You say you'd rather be alone, 'cause you think you won't find it tied to someone else. Who said it's true that the growing only happens on your own? They don't know me and you. I don't don't think you have to leave. If to change is what you need, you can change right next to me. When you're high, I'll take the lows. You can ebb and I can flow. And we'll take it slow and grow as we go. Grow as we go. You won't be the only one. I am unfinished, I've got so much left to learn. I don't know how this river runs, but I'd like the company through every twist and turn. Who says it's true that the growing only happens on your own? They don't know me and you. You don't ever have to leap. If to change is what you need, you can change right next to me. When you're high, I'll take the lows. You can ebb and I can flow. And we'll take it slow and grow as we go. Ooh, grow as we go. Grow as we go. It's not written in the stars, but I believe that when it's done, we're gonna see that it was better that we grew up together. Tell me you don't wanna leave, 'cause if change is what you need, you can change right next to me. When you're high, I'll take the lows. You can ebb and I can flow. We'll take it slow and grow as we go. Grow as we go.
So coming back, and we had to ask these the Liberal Party and Justin Trudeau, what would he do if he came back to power when he was voted in 4 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And he said he would increase, and he never did. So shame on Justin Trudeau. But the thing is that the capacity that we've lost there is in care, because what's being funded at the moment is prevention to people who don't have HIV.
Mm-hmm.
So the $26 million for community and communities across Canada.
Yeah.
And we're talking specifically STBBI or HIV money is $26 million across Canada. There's no more than that.
Okay.
The fund is bigger because there's research and everything else that goes into that fund.
I feel like that's less than a dollar per person.
It is.
Yeah.
So, but, and they've washed down the numbers and so on and so forth. So it's like there's really something happening here. So to look better, you know, the PHAC has put everything into. Anyways, it's really a question of how it looks and how to look good.
Right.
So the thing is that if we're saying that 50% of the cases, of the new cases, are people who know they're infected.
Yeah.
Because they're not getting care and support anymore,
mm-hmm.
which is a secondary prevention model that they don't want to fund. So people who have really bad social determinants of health,
yeah.
we're talking about housing, we're talking about food security, we're talking about medical security to get to appointments and all that.
Social isolation.
Yeah, and we're talking about as much rural as urban.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you want to go see urban disparity, go to Montreal or Toronto.
Yeah.
And you'll see that, and then Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we have no more support for people who are who have extreme life challenges.
Yeah.
And excuse me, but this government doesn't give a shit.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. Because we're talking about really responding to housing. Did you see the mayors came all together in January, said we need more money for housing? No, but they'll go give it to SNC-Lavalin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, who are the friends? So I find that this government is completely seeped into the corporate sector, helping the corporate sector.
Well, you know the big joke about the Liberal Party is that their primary platform is getting reelected.
They're not going to get reelected because they're alienating the gay vote, the LGBT vote. I'm sorry. Randy Boissonneau did not do his job. They did not effectively approach the community organizations across Canada.
Yeah.
You know, like they had a good start with the mental health envelope.
Yeah.
4 years ago when Jane Philpott told the provincials, mm-hmm. governments, if you're not going to do mental health, you're not getting the money.
I feel like they're doing a pretty good job with refugees, but...
Depends on where,
yeah.
Because, you know, Sebastian, the basis of Canada is we're a federation.
Yes.
And that's, you know, like some a journalist asked me a couple of weeks ago, he said, what's the biggest barriers to health outcomes in Canada? I said, our own health system.
Yes.
Because, I mean, when I am a gay man in Ottawa, living in Gatineau, and mm-hmm. I can't even get tested for HIV.
Yeah.
That's unacceptable.
That's not a good sign. Yeah.
That's not a good sign.
Yeah.
When test results stayed in their computers for 6 months without them calling to give the results to testing in Gatineau.
They're on the no news is good news model.
Yeah.
In waiting 3 months and then you don't hear back and then you say, I guess I'm fine then. That's not great.
Well, that's the model they have, is that if you don't hear from us, you're okay.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because how are you increasing sexual health capacity for people? And that's where we're going as a model.
I mean, it also feels like garbage. I've had, in the past, I had a friend text me and say, I just got bad news. You should go test it now. I'm like, all right. So I've had to have the testing done. And they said, if we don't get to you by Friday, then Friday or Monday...
You're good to go.
You're good. It's horrible. Meanwhile, they have these automated systems now where just like every Friday an info dump happens and then it just texts 1,000 people. Your results come back, -. All right, there you go. It's not a hard system. I mean, I'm also coming from a tech background that I know how computers work.
Yes, I know them too. that's what scares me.
It's not a hard system to implement.
It's not.
It's going to cost money to implement it, but you implement it once and then you're good for the next 20 years.
But Sebastian, when we did our first national testing day for HIV last year,
right?
We tested 1,000 people in Canada.
Just 1,000?
In 1 day. Just 1,000, because we had 40,000 to do this day.
Okay.
The government doesn't believe, the federal government doesn't want to help us.
Hmm.
And we can't go provincially because we're a federal organization.
Right, okay.
So, you know, catch 22. And the issue is, you go in the Maritimes, they have no point of care testing where you have rapid testing. You have a prick on the end of your finger and you know if you have HIV, mm-hmm. Hep C, or syphilis in 20 seconds.
Yes.
We don't have that technology in Canada, by the way. We only have HIV.
I've seen the UK, they have...
Yes, they have it.
They're really made in Canada. Really elaborate systems. They're made in Canada.
Yes.
Oh, of course they are.
Okay, but the cost to get them normalized in Canada are too high for the return on investment. So Health Canada is not helping us either for normalization of these testing kits. We have dry blood spots, though.
Okay.
Which are being rolled out in PEI, which are great.
I'm all for cost-benefit analyses,
but yep.
I don't know if this is a case where that is relevant. I feel like it's just worth the price of setting the standard and saying the following brands are deemed acceptably good. Because there's like 30 of them out there or something like that. I know. There's a lot of varieties of testing kits. Well,
the home testing kit, one of them was invented by a professor at McGill.
Okay,
like, come on, get with it, guys. Mm. I mean, get your head out of your asshole and get it done. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket science to know if the testing kit made in Canada is being used normalized in the UK, why can't we use that data instead of having our own Canadian data?
Yep.
To a certain extent. You know, there's a fine line when we come to medication. Yes, some things like that, they should go through an appropriation.
Yeah.
But I mean, when it's a kit where you prick your finger and you get it, I have a test on my desk. I could do it within 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, when you don't have access to that in Quebec, except for Montreal and Quebec City have point-of-care testing.
Yeah.
Everywhere else, it's barren.
Right.
When you are going to New Brunswick, and the sexual health clinics are called women's sexual health clinics.
Mm-hmm.
How does a man go walk in there and get tested?
Yeah.
You're re-stigmatizing. You're re-punishing so many people.
Yeah,
putting so many barriers to get holistic health care.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where we want to change things. And that's where we're changing things on the community level. I re-met with the Vice President of Public Health Agency of Canada. And I said, you know, guys, give it as a sponsorship. Give us $100,000 so that we could really coordinate a really effective press presence across the country with MPs in each testing city and everything else. Because we had a lot of them testing last year.
Right.
I wouldn't promote the Liberals because they didn't give us any money either. Right. So that was the thing. And, you know, like, even Randy Boissonneau went to Edmonton and had a blood draw. He didn't even have a point of care.
Okay.
It doesn't make sense. So we were there, and I was in Regina. I was in Saskatoon at Ground Zero.
Right.
That's where the testing day started. And we were testing, like, people like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was, and it was amazing. And we have some positives, but we brought out in the Maritimes, the point-of-care testing sets, because we gave them to the local health authorities free of charge.
Okay.
Because Biolytical, who make them out in Vancouver, gave us 2,000 testing kits.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
So that changed the game. But even the assistant deputy ministers of the provinces did not get on board, some of them. So when you have that, and you're there, and the federal government says, well, we don't want to rock the boat on the provinces and territories, you know, like, this is really like their jurisdiction. Yeah, but you have a mandate to effectively change the medical landscape in Canada to ensure that the dollars that you're investing are bringing out positive health outcomes in Canadians. By not doing your job, your hands are dirty and the blood of people dying are on your hands if you're not effectively doing your work correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I told them. And they're like, oh, no, we can't push the provinces, but you can influence change. You could say we are giving you a pocket of money to ensure that the national coordination of this is done. That's totally legal, totally okay, and totally holistic and going in the way that most provinces are really happy to go, but they need a helping hand because the costs have to be reattributed somewhere to the point of care testing kits and so on and so forth. We did in Cape Breton, that don't have much there, 38 tests in one day with point of care.
Okay.
They had never seen a point of care kit in their lives. But we had Biolytical give training to where it was needed.
Okay.
Okay. In Quebec, we had a non-testing day. Because in the eastern townships of Montreal, they did not want to go for the training, which was half a day for this. I had the training in 5 minutes in my office.
Okay.
So it's like, you know, there's so they had an on-testing day. So we went rogue into the Maritimes with the testing kits.
Yeah.
Well, I was told, oh, Gary, that's dangerous. We can't do that. And I'm there, but that's what we have to do if we're going to affect change.
Yeah.
And we're affecting change on something that you, as a federal government, approved.
And I also, from what I understand, the testing kits are specifically designed to mimic diabetes prick test as much as possible to minimize the cost of training and to minimize...
Yes, that's exactly
to it. Make it look as similar as possible so that if you can do the one, you can do the other. It's not a problem.
It's totally like that, and it's
they great. Even use a similar technology in the actual testing strips as well. But that's a...
Well, it's a pod.
It's a biochemistry. Oh, they do the water thing.
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
Because there's also one that has like a paper, and then it has like the tagged antibodies there, and it'll turn color, and it's not a accurate.
Yeah.
It has a higher misfire rate, but it's also incredibly cheap, so it's you can make.
But the one where that's standardized in Canada has the same effective rate as a blood transfusion, as a blood draw.
So the lab test and the
Insta test, are equal.
Okay.
But if somebody comes positive on the Insta, on the point of care testing, they have to have a blood draw.
Okay.
So, you know, like that's doubling the cost. But, I mean, get them in whichever way is going to work.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all a question of adapting our testing technologies to respond to how we can get testing done.
Yes.
Increase empowerment through awareness or platforms or information, however you want to increase empowerment.
Right.
You know, like we're doing, we got funded by Scotiabank for 3 years to develop sexual health knowledge for youth.
Okay.
So we're going to increase their sexual health capacity.
Right.
On all sexually transmitted disease and bloodborne.
Okay.
So that's in the works. It's one of my employees that has that under his responsibility. So we're really going that way, is to increase empowerment. How will youth increase their empowerment? We don't know. We'll find out in the next year.
Right.
And we'll be there for Froth Week with our new tools and test them to see if they really hold the ground. If they do, it will be a national broadcasting of this over the next 2 years after. So, okay. You know, that's the way we're going. Are we going to be successful? Who knows? But if we don't try, we're never going to get there.
Right, yeah.
But Scotiabank believed enough in the Canadian AIDS Society that they invested $300,000 to do it.
Well done.
Where government's not doing sweet FA.
Yeah.
Sorry. So, and if we don't have a coordinated effort to get there, we're never going to get there.
Right,
and that's the problem. And, you know, like, and I look at these thousands of people who are on these quilts, and we owe it to them to do it.
Yes.
You know, we owe it to them to, because they died because they were shunned upon.
Mm-hmm.
They died because I was not out in those days, but I was in the bushes in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to do it quick and dirty. That's the way it was in the 1970s and the 80s when you were married and you weren't out.
Right.
So, you know, like I was lucky that I did not contract HIV at the time.
Right.
But this is maybe an acknowledgement of their sacrifice for us as we move forward to ensure that people don't get infected, don't die. And I think that's...
And that we support those who do.
That we support those who do in a respectful way.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I'd like the governments and people to understand that the statistics of HIV, each number is a person.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we forget that in the industry. And we have to talk about have to label the things correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, I have my staff started here and the volunteers that come from the University of Ottawa. Like, we talk about the names that we talk in the industry.
Yeah.
Like I was saying, do you know what an MSM is?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. Of course.
Yes, you do. But they don't. They said, well, I don't know. Well, it's a man who has sex with a man who has sex with men.
Yeah.
It's an MSM. Well, how do you... Okay. Isn't that a gay guy?
Well, I mean...
Well, there's gay, bisexual, queer, two-spirit, trans, whatever.
Yeah.
That's the way. However you identify, we have to be able to label it that way.
Right. Well, also MSM is supposed to capture...
But we know today that if you take your meds continuously, you become undetectable.
Yep.
And you can't transmit.
Yep.
So how empowering is that?
Yeah.
But if you can't get the people to get tested, and you can't because there's stigmatization in getting tested, there's criminalization, all the other social determinants, you don't get them there.
And the meds aren't free either. That's another issue.
Well, in most provinces, it's pretty free. There's also compassionate programs from the drug companies.
Okay.
There's I mean, for PrEP, if you really want to get PrEP, there are other ways of getting the pills than paying $1,000 a month.
Right.
You could get different things too. So, like, I mean, there's ways of going around it. I mean, it's not. When I was an executive director in Montreal of an organization, this one guy came up to me. He says, "I want to talk to you. Come on to swing in the back."
Okay.
Not to swing in the back, on our swing set in the back.
Right. Yeah.
You know. Let's be clear. And he said, "What do you think of me? When you see me, who do you look at?" I say, "I see a guy who has a lot to give because you're an amazing volunteer here. And, you know, you are living with HIV."
Mm-hmm.
He says, "I like that because HIV does not define who I am. Yeah. It's a part of who I am."
Yeah.
And I love that analogy.
Yeah.
Because that's where we have to get. Because as long as we don't settle the self-stigmatization of people living with HIV,
mm-hmm.
we'll never be able to get the stigma that mm-hmm. lives in HIV. Because, I mean, if you know your own worth and you're proud and you're loud of who you are, nobody could take you down.
Right.
And that's where we're not getting. And that's where we come back to empowerment,
mm-hmm.
to the cause de départ, and what Jay was saying. And it's that's where it lies. And I believe in that. And that's where these quilts, and I come back to quilts, these quilts empower us. I mean, I come here and I go through our website, quilt.ca, and you could see the provenance of each section.
Right, yeah.
See the stories of each section. And it's important to continue talking about those sections. You know, you're talking about Gaétan Dugas. Well, you could go on the quilt website and see his panel.
Okay.
When it came out that he was not ground zero, we have an event on Parliament Hill every year for the 1st of December,
right.
where we meet the MPs and the senators and everybody. And we have, I don't know where we're going to be in the new building,
right?
But we have a quilt out. And we brought expressly that quilt with Gaétan on it to Parliament to talk about Ground Zero,
right, the patient,
and how misled we can be with a history.
Mm-hmm.
And what this also highlights, this whole thing that we have here, the quilts and everything else, is that this history can't be denied.
Yeah.
You know, like, absolutely. We don't have grave plots for a lot of these people, but we have a living legacy of their quilts.
Right.
Which is an amazing tool. You know, and how they, and it is so. I get so mad with the bureaucrats at PHAC when they start talking about statistics and how to get there and how to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they say, we have 2,400 cases of HIV last year, but we only know 60% of what they were.
Right.
What the population was, if they were gay, if they were from endemic countries and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, so in reality, you don't know the other 40%.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have modeling to see who they were.
Okay.
Well, if your modeling doesn't work, you're misleading the whole fund and how we're doing this. So by going population-centric for your prevention, can I swear? You're effing missing the mark. Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and they're there. And when you tell them that, they're like, they don't know what to say.
Yeah.
So you're...
I mean, that's also really weird. Like, I am, through my biology background, trained on how to develop models.
Yeah.
And how to... Actually, I've done some really bizarre things with computers, developing computer models. And I can tell you right now, that's not something you can model. It's just not. It's the kind of thing you could predict with...
Call Mr. Archibald at PHAC and tell him that, because he's the chief modeler.
Basic statistics, you could say it's likely that blah, 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 but I would not put a high confidence on that. It would be like, this is the kind of, like, modeling in this case gives you hints on where to look for real data.
Yeah.
I would not rely on this kind of modeling. It's a very good roadmap for, like, we don't know who the other 40% are. We're going to have to guess. let's do minor modeling, but you know it's going to be wrong, but you also know that it's a very good starting point on where to look. And rural communities, I know that there's the, I can never remember the name of the, the full name of the organization. It's the South Asian Gay Men's something something.
Alliance in Toronto.
Yeah, in Toronto, yeah. They're getting very assertive about dealing with their community, because they have specific cultural needs that mean that reaching out to them and talking about sexuality in general, let alone sexual disease, it's not that it can't be done. Obviously, they're grown-ups, they're adults, but there's a certain kind of cultural sensitivity that you need to convey that information in a way that makes them listen. And growing up biculturally, like having an English family and a French family, talking with my French family about sex, there's certain things where there are no taboos, and there's every so often they'll clam up about something, and I'm like, this is where you draw the line in the sand. That's weird. But it's cultural differences.
Appropriateness is different everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Look at Lori Petito, who does the sex show.
Like a sexologist.
Sexologist.
Okay.
And she has a radio show on CJD at 10 o'clock every day.
Okay.
At night. It has to be at night, you know.
Yeah.
I found that they are more advanced in how they approach subject matter and discuss it than the French population. Though, we always associate more promiscuity with French population than English.
Really? Well,
being from Montreal, I found that.
Yeah.
So we say the openness of sexuality is very open in the French population.
Yeah. Like, if you're going to talk about sex at all, you're probably going to be a little bit crass.
Yeah, but...
But?
The sex education courses were brought down by the French population. Mm. Were taken out of schools.
Yeah.
And the biggest pushback to have it brought back into schools 3 years ago was from the French population.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, and my mind was blown when I was thinking of it. You're thinking of it there.
I mean, a lot of it is the echoes of the Quiet Revolution.
Yeah.
The Catholic versus revolution tension has not ended. It's not as big as it was in the 60s, but it hasn't gone away.
No, because I'm a bastard of language.
Yeah.
Because I'm half English, half French. My father was Franco-Ontarian. My mother was from BC.
Okay.
So I was, I guess, first generation Quebecois. Imagine that. I speak French. That's where we have to also adapt.
Thank you.
And welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is still Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
And you just listened to Siren Song by Maruv.
Mm-hmm.
And this is probably the only time you're ever going to hear it. Because the Ukraine has decided not to send Maruv,
right,
who was the winner of their own national competition, to the Eurovision Song Contest.
Right.
They have decided, nope, we're not going to send her, we're not going to participate, because she refused to sign on to the broadcaster's terms as part of entering her into the competition.
Right.
So,
and this is an internal thing to Ukraine. This is not a Eurovision problem.
Yeah, so okay. She won the internal contest in February. The Eurovision Song Contest is one of the biggest single-day television events in the world. It has a global audience. It's absolutely massive. You know, where, you know, the Super Bowl has the United States and Canada, Eurovision has Europe, Israel, Australia. It's like, it's...
And more people watch Eurovision anyway, like, proportionally. It's I think the only thing that's on the same par is the, I can't remember what it's called, the finals, the last match thingy.
Like the football final, the FIFA.
FIFA finals.
Or like a royal wedding or death or something.
It's on the same scale as that.
Yeah. So it's huge. And understandably, the public broadcaster for the Ukraine wants to have some control over what is or isn't said.
Right.
Bearing in mind that a few years ago, Russia annexed the portion of Crimea, which was a Ukrainian territory.
Yeah.
Russia just decided that it was theirs now. And there's continued Russian aggression on the border. So as part of the terms, the Ukrainian contestant is banned from touring in Russia, as well as really saying or doing anything that isn't vetted by the Ukraine government. Like, they are very particular on what somebody would say or do in front of one of the largest TV audiences in the world. And on the one hand, I'm like, okay, yeah, I get it. But on the other hand,
I'm sure all of the contestants, regardless of where they're from, have some kind of restriction about what they can and can't do on stage. Yeah, no, this is at a new level that, like, she's not allowed to improvise. She's not allowed, like, I think she only can give scripted answers, and it's pretty bananas. And for an artist to basically say, like, some of these restrictions are so tight, she's kind of guaranteed to fail. It's hard to imagine a future where she's not going to get sued by the government, basically.
So she said on Facebook, the ability to hold concerts in Russia was not fundamental for us. The main differences between her and the Ukraine state were caused by the other clauses of the agreement, which if I signed would have become enslaving for me. I'm a citizen of the Ukraine, pay taxes, sincerely love the Ukraine, but I'm not ready to come up with slogans turning my stay at the contest into a promotion tour by the politicians. Essentially saying she's a singer, not a political tool.
I mean, that kind of is what Eurovision is. You are representing your country. But there's right ways and wrong ways to do that, and I think they just stumbled across the wrong way.
So there were threats of fines, have been to quite significant fines if she was improvising or saying something that she shouldn't have been. This is very restrictive.
It's not even stuff like, you know, Viva la Revolution. Like, they're not even putting restrictions on stuff like that. It could just be, I don't know, doing a sexy dance and wiggling her bum when she's expected to do a non-wiggle-your-bum dance. Or the backup dancers, all her backup dancers, because we saw a clip, are women. And you could do, easily, you could do something to do with LGBT activism with so many women on stage. You could do something. So there's a lot of potential here, and it doesn't have to be some kind of, like, Ukraine, anti-Russia, pro-EU, or vice versa, kind of anything. Like, there's a million ways you can go with this. It could even be about environmentalism. She could say, you know, like, fund solar, you know? And that could still be on the no list. And it's, granted, I think if even you know, a non-restricted country. So you look at, like, Sweden, for example. If people from Sweden came out and said, fund solar, I'm sure the Swedish government would be like, why are you talking about funding programs and green energies during Eurovision? Like, during an interview, maybe, but not when you're on stage. That's bizarre. So, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, I get where they're coming from, but the details of it are just irrational. It's a rational idea taken to an irrational degree, and I don't blame her for stepping down. But also, like, it's really expensive to participate in Eurovision.
It really is. And
isn't it like $1 billion thing?
I don't know if it's $1 billion, but the public broadcasters have to front the money.
Yeah.
And you have to sort of pay into it. So I can understand how, if there's a lot of public funds going into it, they've got to be very careful. But I mean, it's the BBC pays for it in Britain and so on and so forth. I did want to pivot to our last story that we have time for. A global international gay guide run by Spartacus does an annual ranking of countries according to where's the best place for LGBT people to visit.
Right.
Canada and Sweden are in joint first place.
Oh, so good.
Go Canada.
Hooray.
That's pretty cool. And I believe Portugal went from the 27th to first joint rank.
Yeah.
They introduced new laws protecting trans folks and initiatives tackling hate crimes.
A lot of exciting things are happening in both Spain and Portugal over the past few years. Yeah.
Since Donald Trump took office, though, the U.S. has gone from the 47th best country to visit to, from 39 to 47.
But they were 39 to start with?
I mean, it's...
What were they under Obama? 39 still?
Yeah, well, there's not so many protections on a state-by-state level.
Oh, right, it's for the entire country. So, yeah, like, exactly. If you throw in Alabama, then yeah, that makes sense.
I don't
sense.
Know why you're picking on Alabama, but Brazil, Germany, and the USA have all dropped in the rankings.
Oh.
India has improved. It went from 104th to 57th. We saw the decriminalization of homosexuality there. Austria and Malta were also...
Where's Poland?
Jumping up.
Does it mention Poland?
I can't see Poland here at a glance. I mean...
Because Poland has started talking about banning conversion therapy in their parliament, which I think is hilarious because Canada has not yet done it. I think it's banned in one province, but I can't remember which province. It's Ontario, isn't it? Yeah, Ontario, it's banned. And then everywhere else in Canada, they're kind of thinking about maybe banning it, although this should be a federal level thing where they're just like, no, ban it. But anyway, yeah.
Oh, yeah, they are 83rd. Poland is 83rd. So they measure it on a few different vectors, civil rights, are they allowed to marry, are there anti-discrimination laws, are there pride parades, can people with HIV travel freely?
Yeah.
You know, are there threats to persons? Is there persecution? Are there hate crimes? These are things that you would consider if you're going to book a weekend trip getaway.
And it is complicated because there are countries where at the state level, they're doing a very good job in terms of giving rights and protections. But at the cultural level, there's still a homophobia problem like on the streets or a transphobia problem on the streets. Or vice versa, where you have, like, a country that is fundamentally open and welcoming, but there's no state protections. So, I mean, some of it gets complicated where, like, Japan has almost nothing in terms of state protections. But the Japanese people, generally speaking, kind of don't care. Like, that's cool, bro. That's your business, you know? And that's a... It's something very important to bear in mind that depending on where you're going, looking at how frequent hate crimes are may be more relevant. Like if you're only there for a week, you know, what state protections are there may not necessarily affect you. But if there's a lot of hate crimes, then that for you should bump it down, which is why I'm glad they broke it up like this and actually showed each of their... Well,
for me, it's like places like Cuba. You're like, oh, you know, because a lot of Canadians go on vacation to Cuba. And you're like, okay, you know, how does that compare? Is that somewhere where I really want to go? You know, is there something that, is that a safe place for me? You know, and this is kind of gives you an idea. By the way, just as an FYI, Cuba was joint 47th with the USA. So,
oh dear.
You know, that's...
they're oh, it's up with, there like, with Macau.
And Thailand,
People forget about Macau.
But like Nepal has a higher ranking than the USA.
So does Mozambique.
Yeah. So there's a lot of places. I thought it's an interesting tool. And we were talking before about how Japan is trying to get more gay dollars. They're trying to get more tourism because they're usually double incomes, no children, which is very good for spending money. So there is a lot of money at risk here. So Japan is actually 68th. They're not doing super stellar on it. But also you said the culture is different.
Yeah, the number of hate crimes is minimal, but the number of protections is not great either at the legal level.
We have run out of time.
Oh,
we have, we're playing out with a Toronto band called Partner, which I adore. This is the Ellen Page song. Ellen Page has been all over the news advocating for all sorts of rights. I like the fact that whenever they put her on a press junket, she uses that time to like raise an issue into the public awareness.
Right.
So she was pushed out for the Umbrella Academy. She was fantastic in that.
Okay.
But she didn't really talk much about the Umbrella Academy and talked more about, you know, there was a church where that there was somebody who was...
Chris Pratt.
Yeah, Chris Pratt's church is allegedly homophobic, and she kind of uses it as a jumping off point. So I thought that was interesting. This is the Ellen Page, my Partner, and I've been Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian, and thanks for listening.
People say that I talk like Ellen Page. That makes sense since we come from the same place, but it's more than just a regional thing, cause if it's 50% maritime, it's 50% lesbian. We're on the same page.